From the heart of our nation's capital in Washington, D.C., bringing compelling interviews, insightful analysis, taking you beyond the headlines and sound bites into conversations with our nation's leaders and newsmakers, all from a biblical worldview. Washington Watch with Tony Perkins starts now.
We're going to get a response from the Iranians by 8 o'clock tonight. I hope they make the right response, because what we really want is we want a world where oil and gas is flowing freely, where people can afford to heat their homes and cool their homes, where people can afford to transport themselves to work. That's not going to happen if the Iranians are engaged in acts of economic terrorism.
That was Vice President J.D. Vance earlier today addressing the U.S. deadline for Iran to reopen the Strait of Hormuz. Welcome to this Tuesday, April 7th edition of Washington Watch. I'm Tony Perkins, your host. Thanks so much for tuning in. Well, coming up, while most eyes are focused on the war in Iran or the battle on Capitol Hill over the funding for the Department of Homeland Security, there is another fight underway, the decades-old fight for life. Senator Bill Cassidy of Louisiana joins us shortly to discuss his latest efforts to address the FDA's failure to act on dangerous chemical abortion drugs. Plus, a new medical study out of Finland is reinforcing the concerns about gender reassignment treatments for minors. The study suggests these interventions worsen mental health outcomes for many gender-confused youth. Wesley J. Smith, chair and senior fellow at the Discovery Institute, will break down the findings. All of that and more straight ahead. Well, President Trump has threatened that, quote, a whole civilization will die tonight, end quote, if Iran does not open the Strait of Hormuz by 8 p.m. Eastern time. Now, this comes after President Trump's warning the U.S. may strike bridges and power plants in Iran. Joining me now with more on this escalating conflict is the Washington Stand's Casey Harper. Casey, the media and leaders on both sides of the political aisle have expressed concern about the president's latest statement.
Yeah, that's right, Tony. The president has certainly grabbed the attention of the entire world. I mean, you have UN leaders, leader of Pakistan, even the Pope, urging the president not to follow through with this. But he seems intent on doing it, and it seems likely now, just a couple hours out, because we have reports that negotiations are pretty much broken down with Iran. Now, meanwhile, the U.S. has struck military targets on Karg Island, just continuing their attacks, but also hitting Karg Island again. However, they made clear that their oil facilities were not attacked. There seems to be a distinction between, you know, the oil fields and the energy power plants, which the president has threatened. And earlier today, actually, Vice President J.D. Vance made that same point when he said that the news from Karg Island doesn't mean that there's some kind of change in President Trump's strategy. There's been concerns about, or talks about, maybe a potential invasion. He seemed to wave away those concerns. But you get the feeling, Tony, that tomorrow, this time when we start this show, it's going to be an entirely different situation in Iran.
Well, the president's going to have a hard time backing down from those statements. Yeah. Given the clear red lines that he's given. Now, a resolution aimed at reopening the Strait of Hormuz was rejected at the United Nations earlier today. Walk us through what unfolded at the UN.
Yeah, that's right. China and Russia really showed their true colors. I guess in some ways we shouldn't have been surprised, but if you thought maybe a global oil supply could get them to come to reason, it didn't prove true today. China and Russia vetoed a UN Security Council resolution which urged, you know, international cooperation and coordination to open and protect the Strait of Hormuz. And they did those vetoes even though 11 of the 15 Security Council members voted in favor. Now, naturally, the U.S. ambassador criticized the vetoes and said that China and Russia are really enabling Iran's actions, which, remember, that importantly includes attacking Gulf states, not just the U.S. and Israel, and really just helping them disrupt and block global trade, not to mention humanitarian aid deliveries. Now, this is all, you know, driving up oil prices because, of course, the Strait of Hormuz channels 20% of the world's oil, another point that the U.S. has been making. In fact, we have a clip from U.S. Ambassador to the U.N. Mike Walls earlier today condemning Russia and China.
No one should tolerate that they are holding the global economy at gunpoint. But today, Russia and China did tolerate it. They sided with a regime that seeks to intimidate the Gulf into submission, even as it brutalizes its own people during a national internet blackout for daring to imagine dignity or freedom.
Now, Walls urged that these responsible nations, that they would join the U.S. in securing the Strait of Hormuz, but China and Russia didn't feel inclined to do that today, Tony.
All right, Casey, very quickly, I want to switch to some national news. We've got some important elections happening today in Wisconsin and Georgia. Fill us in on what's at stake in those elections.
Yeah, that's right. I'll just hit the highlights. Voters in Wisconsin are heading to the polls, and they're choosing a new member of the state Supreme Court. It's a race between Maria Lazar and Chris Taylor. They're not going to be able to flip the whole court, but an important seat there. And meanwhile, in Georgia, a special election runoff is underway to fill the seat of Marjorie Taylor Greene, who very publicly and dramatically, of course, resigned from Congress. In that race, we have Republican Clay Fuller and Democrat Sean Harris. And that's a one that Speaker Mike Johnson and others are going to be watching closely because Republicans have that very thin majority, Tony.
All right. Well, if you live in those two states, you still have time to go out and vote. Casey, we'll see you a little bit later in the program. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Tony.
All right. The Senate Committee on Health recently launched an investigation into the chemical abortion manufacturers to see if they are complying with the minimal regulations that still exist for the oversight of the abortion drug. Now, the committee also urged the FDA to combat the unapproved and misbranded chemical drugs being sold online from outside the country that are endangering the lives of women. Joining us now to discuss this is Senator Bill Cassidy from my home state of Louisiana. He chairs the Senate Committee on Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions. He is also a medical doctor and a member of the Senate Finance Committee as well. Senator Cassidy, welcome back to Washington Watch. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, Tony, very good to be with you, and forgive me for being in a car. I'm in campaign season, so I'm going across our state.
I understand. I've been down that path myself a few times. Before we jump into the life issue, I just want to get your read on the ongoing shutdown of the Department of Homeland Security. Are we close? Have there been any developments in the last 24 hours?
In the last 48 hours, there has been the development of the House agreeing to the plan developed by the Senate with President Trump. This will allow a reopening of government, a reopening of the, at least that portion of it, which is currently shut down. That will be the set back.
Yep, I think we may have lost the senator there. We'll need to see if we can. All right, we lost you there for a minute. Okay, try it again.
Yes, I do think there's a solution. I have to agree with the plan worked out by the president, and I think we will be able to get some relatively quickly.
All right, very good. Well, let's move before we lose you again. Let's go back to the life issue. You launched an investigation as chairman of the committee into abortion drug manufacturers. What's this investigation centered on?
So there's a whole lot of issues as regards these abortion drugs. Let's just start with that. And some of these are coming from overseas. They're unregulated. We don't know the chemical content. We don't know if they're safe. Of course, we know if they have their intended effect that the child dies. But we also want to protect the mother. And right now, we're not sure that is happening. And so all that to say, we'll begin our investigation by that to make sure that these unregulated drugs not prescribed by a doctor coming overseas, that the FDA is looking after this.
I mean, isn't this the job of the FDA?
It is the job of the FDA.
And they're not doing it.
They're not doing it. Arguably, this FDA has not been very aggressive. In fact, no, I'm being kind. This FDA has turned a blind eye to issues that are important to those who are pro-life like you and I are. For example, approving generic abortion drugs without the requirement to have the REMS database. That's looking for complications. There's evidence that the way women are taking these pills now have an increased rate of complications. That should be thoroughly investigated. It is not being thoroughly investigated. And that's what I'm pushing the FDA to do.
Now, you also had a hearing month before last on this very topic, because what happened with the Dobbs decision is that it allowed legislators, both federal and state, but primarily at the state level, to regulate the issue of life. But that's being undermined by a policy put in place during the Biden administration on these abortion drugs that allow them to be prescribed without in-person consultation and through the U.S. mail, both of which historically have been contrary to the law and policy. Why is that still in place?
I don't know why not. And that's what we are pursuing in our investigation. First, we had this hearing and we wanted to inform people that, unlike what Democrats are saying, that if you take this pill, it's not like taking a Tylenol. It is a pill which results in the death of the child by design, and sometimes with a complication and some evidence, even the death of the mother. And you do that by informing people of how it's happening. When you give it online, somebody in California is prescribing a medication for someone in Louisiana. The patient didn't request it. The mother did. And the mother is coercing the child who is pregnant, or her child who's pregnant, to take the pill. Tony, there's a case in one of our parishes in which the daughter wanted to have a gender reveal party. The mother coerced her into taking the pills. She ended up in the emergency room with a complication because she was an inappropriate candidate for these medications. Now, that is wrong. And so an in-person visit would allow a doctor to say, wait, are you being coerced? If you're being coerced, I'm not going to give you medicine. In fact, I'm going to call the police, because you shouldn't be taking this unless you know the complication which is going to occur. That's what we're trying to inform people, and that's why the FDA should be taking a more aggressive action on it.
Well, Senator Cassidy, that example that you just laid out is actually something that's happened in multiple states. Texas actually has a number of cases in which the partner of the pregnant woman did not want the baby and surreptitiously gave her the drug. I mean, that's murder, and that's being facilitated by this policy.
And so, Tony, think about it. I'm a doctor. So the indication for the medicine, you're not supposed to take it after week 11 or 15 of pregnancy. But somebody buying online, like John Smith, well, wait a second, that should be a red flag. It's not Susan Smith, it's John Smith. John Smith gets it, gives it to the wife when she's 20 weeks pregnant. At this point, the fetus can be too large to pass out of the womb. And so it gets, once the fetus is dead, it stays in the womb. That leads to a complication. That complication leads to an ER visit and other complications like infection or sepsis. I think there's claims data from insurance companies that this may be occurring. If you're pro-life, you should be about making sure this doesn't happen. By the way, if you're pro-abortion, you should make sure this doesn't happen. This is wrong. This is endangering the life of the mother.
Yeah, in fact, even those who do support abortion support the in-person consultation that was previously in place for this dangerous drug. We just have a little less than a minute left. Senator, you gave the FDA the FDA and these manufacturers until tomorrow to respond. 30 seconds left. Any response yet?
We've not received responses yet. Now, they can... It doesn't have to come by U.S. mail, so they could email it in, if you will. But we're looking to see what that response is. Why are these international companies not being regulated as they ship drug into our country, which FDA should be cracking down on, but they're not, particularly when the design of the drug is to kill the fetus, but in some cases it damages the mother. And that's assuming that they're pure and otherwise not adulterated. It's an important issue for us to look at, Tony.
Well, Senator, I appreciate you for joining us today, but also appreciate your leadership on this issue and as chairman of the committee looking into this and getting answers. Folks, stick with us. We're back with more after this.
Proverbs 22:6 says, "Train up a child in the way he should go. Even when he is old, he will not depart from it."
For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whoever believes in him shall not perish, but have eternal life. John 3:16.
For I know that my Redeemer lives. Job 19:25.
God raised Jesus from the dead because it was impossible for death to hold on him. Acts 2:24.
Join Family Research Council in standing on the Word. Visit frc.org/Bible for free resources to help your family follow the way, Jesus, the risen Savior of the world.
The family is the oldest, most tested, and most reliable unit of society. It is divinely created and sustained. And yet, there are those who are always tampering with its values and structure. That's why we need organizations like the Family Research Council that can effectively defend and strengthen the family.
Family Research Council began over 40 years ago, like all great movements of God, with prayer. Today, rooted in the heart of the nation's capital, FRC continues to champion faith, family, and freedom in public policy and the culture from a biblical worldview.
FRC is one of those bright lights that helps us focus on true north. And I shudder to think, had they not been here, that it could have been worse, worse, worse.
The Family Research Council is key. It's one of a handful of groups that I think will determine whether our children live in a country that enjoyed all of the freedom and all the opportunity that we enjoyed in this great land.
It's just a wonderful parachurch organization that doesn't seek to take the place of the church, but it seeks to assist the family and the church as we try to move forward successfully, not in a defensive mode, but in an offensive mode as we seek to live our lives according to the Holy Scriptures.
FRC is not going to be whooped. we're going to fight. We're going to take a stand. And again, we don't retreat.
You will never see in front of this building here in Washington, D.C., a white flag fly. We will never step back. We will never surrender. And we will never be silent.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I ran out of time in that previous segment. I just want to encourage you to weigh in on this as well. Let your voice be heard. Text the word LIFE, that's LIFE, to 67742, LIFE to 67742, and you can add your voice to the tens of thousands of Americans who want the FDA to take action on this. So text LIFE to 67742. All right, the pushback against the radical transgender ideology continues to build momentum. Yesterday, the Department of Education Civil Rights Office freed schools from being forced to comply with the Biden administration's distorted interpretation of the Title IX civil rights law, which rolled gender into the law that prohibited sex-based discrimination. Well, and the science actually backs that decision up and so many more. A new medical study out of Finland challenges the myth that gender transition procedures are medically necessary for young people's mental health. This is a big argument that they've been using. Well, joining us now to discuss these developments is Wesley J. Smith, chair and senior fellow at the Discovery Institute Center on Human Exceptionalism. He has been recognized as one of America's premier public intellectuals on bioethics and was honored by the Human Life Foundation as the great defender of life for his work against suicide and euthanasia. Wesley, welcome to Washington Watch. Good to see you again.
Thank you, Tony. Long time no talk to.
Yeah, it's great to have you back on the program. So let me first describe the findings of this study, what this study did, and then how significant you think the findings are.
I think it's very significant. Finland, which of course is not a Bible Belt country, they studied more than 2,000 young people, adolescents and young adults, with gender confusion that had sought what they call gender reassignment. That could be puberty blockers, that could be surgery. And supposedly, when you get these interventions, if you will, you're supposed to end up with better mental health. But what they found, and I'll read it from the study itself rather than summarize it. Many of the, it says, quote, considerable increases in need for psychiatric treatment were seen among those adolescents who had undergone medical gender reassignment. And it went on to say, regardless of gender, adolescents suffering from gender dysphoria present with excessive psychiatric morbidity, subsequent to medical gender reassignment, psychiatric treatment needs appear to increase. In other words, the young people who received these interventions got worse, not better.
Yeah, they weren't marginal. It wasn't a marginal increase. It was a quite significant increase in the percentage of those having the psychological issues. Now, one thing I want to point out on this study, Wesley, is that Finland, as you pointed out, certainly not the Bible Belt. This is where they're just prosecuting a member of parliament for using a Bible verse. But they have a socialized healthcare system, so they have a large pool of which to work with. So this is unlike some of the studies here that are kind of self-described and analyzed. This is a kind of a global look at their healthcare system. So it gives us a lot to work with.
It certainly does. I mean, you're following more than 2,000 people, and they also had a control group that did not receive the interventions, and the control group did much better. You know, Tony, we've seen this, let's say, for the last 3 or 4 years. Before that, this is absolutely necessary. It's life-saving. If kids don't get gender reassignment, they'll commit suicide, that kind of thing. Those studies, which this study also dealt with, were based on really flimsy evidence. And starting 3, 4, 5 years ago, you began to see a lot of countries pulling back on puberty blockers and surgeries, UK, Finland, Sweden, Norway, and others, because the evidence wasn't there. And we've seen other reports similar to this Finnish study that show that actually this should not be the medical standard of care. And what's really upsetting to me is how many within the American medical establishment are holding on to gender ideology with tight fists. And really, this needs to change. And the last administration, I don't mean to get partisan, but you had Rachel Levine, who is one of the big HHS people, who was a transgendered person, who pressured a very ideological medical group called WPATH to do away with all age limits on these interventions. So the last administration was based on ideology, and now let's follow the science. And the science says that this is not how we should treat young people.
Well, but that's what we're always told, the left is adherents of the science. But we know that is not the case. But it does point that elections have consequences. I want to go back to the percentage increase. And those males that had medical gender reassignment treatments, there was a 518% increase in the psychiatric morbidities. I mean, that is quite significant. Among females, it was 151%. I mean, we're told, right. I mean, one of the lines, and I had the former Attorney General of Missouri on the program multiple times. He's now working for the FBI. But he said that, you know, the line that was used by those pushing this in Missouri was, well, either you can have a, you know, talking about their boy, you can have a girl or a dead boy. Pushing this idea that they were going to commit suicide, when in fact the studies, the science shows they're more likely to commit suicide if you go forward with this.
And I'm sure you know who Chloe Cole is, who's what is known as a detransitioner. She said that when she was being pressured to change her quote, gender, close quote, her parents were told that she would commit suicide if she wasn't given a mastectomy at age 15. Double mastectomy at age 15. And she said, I was never suicidal. I heard her give a speech. And so you found that this ideology was not only pushing people, but it was really destroying the lives of people whose bodies will never be the same.
Right. Just have a little over a minute left, Wesley. We point to these studies coming from Finland and elsewhere, but one of the things we've seen in academia is that there is either a reluctance, a fear, or a refusal to actually study these issues and apply the science.
Yeah, you know, there is a lot of pressure and peer pressure in these issues. And you also see a lot in terms of some states that are saying that if parents don't go along with this, they could lose custody of their children.
Right.
So the battle has not been won yet, but at least now no one can say with a straight face, this is the medical standard of care, because it sure isn't.
Right. This is the time to get to work while we have an administration that has some common sense to it, that we can build this body of evidence to create a firewall for the future. Wesley,
you're protecting
always great
children.
Yes, absolutely. Protect the children. That's what this is about. So great to see you. Thanks so much for taking time to join us today and keep up the great work.
Thank you, Tony.
All right. Wesley Smith. Look, this is so important that we stay involved and engaged, and this is a prayer point as well. All right, don't go away. We're back with more Washington Watch right after this break.
I think all people really need to have this type of education.
Well, I can tell you that it's been an amazing course, period.
I think this course is a reminder that a biblical worldview should really impact everything. It impacts our government from the federal to the state to the local. It should impact what we're doing with our families and with our work.
God and Government is a video-driven, Bible-based training course from Family Research Council that explores the connection between biblical principles and American government. In this six-session video series, FRC President Tony Perkins equips participants with a practical understanding of civil government from a biblical worldview.
I would encourage all people to take it. I almost wish I would have took it earlier, that I could have taught my kids this.
I wish I had known these things when we were homeschooling, because I think children and my adults now would just greatly be influenced by that information.
So I'm an attorney, and for me, it gives me some direct practical knowledge of what I can do to try to impact my legal community, to make better legislation, to try to encourage legislators to make choices that have a biblical worldview, which is what we really want.
Any pastor would benefit from taking this course because we are dual citizens, right? We are citizens of the kingdom of God, but we're also citizens of this great land, and that comes with responsibility.
Even as someone who has been involved in these types of issues for a while, you're learning little bits and pieces of new stuff all the time. But it's also approachable enough that newer people, younger people, high school, college students, they can really glean something from this. So I would encourage everybody to take this course, whether it's the videos, whether it's doing it in person. Bring your Bible study group through it, bring your homeschool group through it, and equip yourself for these challenging days ahead.
View the course at frc.org/God and Government or on the Stand Firm app.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. Thanks so much for joining us and being a part of the program. Let me give you something to weigh in on the gender ideology issue, the transgender issue. There is a bill in Congress. Wesley made reference to Coe Coal. That is the Coe Coal Act. And I want to encourage you to send a message to your members of Congress urging them to support this important bill. So text KIDS, KIDS, K-I-D-S, to 67742, 67742, the word KIDS, and be a part of pushing this across the line. Now is the time we've got to do this work. We've got an administration that is filled with, in the ranks, a lot of folks that share our concerns and our conservative ideology, our biblical ideology in many places. And so now is the time to go to work. And as I mentioned earlier with Senator Cassidy, build that fire. Well, actually, it was with Wesley, building that firewall around our families, around our kids. So text the word KIDS to 67742. All right, speaking of attacks, for the last 2 years now, about a dozen New York pregnancy care centers have been engaged in a legal battle against their state's Democratic Attorney General, Letitia James. Heard that name before? She wants to stop them from sharing about how a woman who may have started the chemical abortion process, you know, what we were talking about with Senator Cassidy earlier, can save their child and continue their pregnancy. There's a reversal pill that's out there. Well, the Attorney General of New York did not want these care pregnancy centers to be able to talk about it. That's right. Next week, these care pregnancy centers will be going to court in defense of that right. Joining us now to discuss this is Christopher Ferreira. He is the senior counsel for Thomas More Society, who is the lead attorney representing the pregnancy help organizations that are going to court. Christopher, welcome to Washington Watch. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So let's start off with what these pregnancy care centers are doing in New York and what the AG is trying to stop.
Well, this is a matter of medical common sense. So-called abortion pill reversal is nothing more than the administration of supplemental progesterone to counteract the effects of mifepristone, which blocks access to progesterone and cuts off signals that sustain the pregnancy, causing the death of the baby. And then the second pill in this barbaric ritual is ingested and the dead child is expelled from the womb. So the common sense here, which is recognized by the FDA in animal studies, by an Obgyn professor at Yale University, multiple peer-reviewed studies, and 15 state legislatures, is that the administration of supplemental progesterone unblocks those receptors and allows the pregnancy to continue to term in a very significant number of cases. And this is confirmed by practice, by physicians across the country. And in terms of the state legislatures who have required that doctors inform women of this option in case they change their minds in the middle of a chemical abortion, it would actually be medical malpractice not to tell women about this option. This is a reproductive choice. And ironically enough, the great paladin of reproductive choice, the Attorney General of the state of New York, is attempting to prevent the circulation of information about this by Christian nonprofit organizations engaged in non-commercial speech.
So tell us about the threat from her. What is she threatening these care pregnancy centers with?
An injunction against saying things that are in favor of abortion pill reversal, or APR, and also massive crushing fines that would bankrupt these organizations. Now, here's the thing which has developed, which makes this all the more outrageous. The Attorney General's lawfare has already been shut down in federal court in the Western District of New York by other organizations that brought a suit, including two that I represent in that consolidated federal action. And in that case, the federal judge issued an injunction which prohibits the Attorney General from misapplying the general business law and the executive law to pro-APR statements, including statements that APR is safe, APR is effective, and also information about how to access a hotline to get you in touch with providers who can provide the supplemental progesterone. And then that injunction by the federal district court was upheld by the Second Circuit Court of Appeals, which found that the judge did not abuse his discretion in finding that this is non-commercial, non-profit speech, religiously motivated, fully protected by the First Amendment. So what is happening in this state case that I'm arguing on Monday is that the Attorney General is trying to do through the back door what she was unable to do through the front door in federal court, which has been slammed in her face. And we think that that is an unworthy tactic. We intend to bring to the court's attention the results in the Second Circuit. And there's another case that just came down, Childs v. Salazar, in which the Supreme Court said that the state of Colorado cannot ban so-called conversion therapy, in which minors who seek to get rid of unwanted same-sex attractions or other sexual problems are not permitted to have that therapy. And there, the state of Colorado said, well, that's the medical consensus. Conversion therapy doesn't work. And the Supreme Court said, you cannot use so-called medical consensus to punish speech which departs from the so-called consensus. And that was an 8-1 decision. And in her concurrence, Justice Kagan noted that if you use that tactic to enforce orthodoxy based on a so-called medical consensus in a liberal state, conservative states will end up doing the same thing.
Right.
And so this is another major development in favor of the right to speak on these issues.
Well, Christopher, we're up against a break, but I will tell you this. We will have our folks praying for you and for the care pregnancy centers there in New York Monday when you go into the court to argue their First Amendment right to be able to speak to the clients that come through their doors. And we appreciate you taking on so many cases, this one in particular. And thanks, Christopher, for joining us today.
You know, prayers are very much appreciated and very necessary.
All right, we will be praying. Folks, will you join me in praying for Christopher and his team on Monday? All right, don't go away. We're coming back with more.
When in the course of human events, it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another, and to assume among the powers of the earth
the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature
and of nature's God entitle them.
A decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes
which impel them to the separation.
We hold these truths to be self-evident.
That all men are created equal.
That they're endowed by their Creator
with certain unalienable rights.
That among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
That to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men,
deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. Happy 250th. Happy 250th.
Happy 250th.
Happy 250th birthday, America. May God bless America.
For over 4,000 years, the Jewish people have had legal, historical, and biblical ties to the land of Israel, especially the heartland of Israel, Judea and Samaria, which much of the world still calls the West Bank. To Israelis, Judea and Samaria is far more than a name. It's the center of their ancestral homeland, where nearly 80% of the Bible's events took place. Abraham purchased property in Hebron, Jacob in Shechem, Joshua made an altar on Mount Ebal and led the Israelites into a covenant before God. On Mount Gerizim, overlooking Shechem, Jesus talked to the Samaritan woman at the well about worshiping neither on Mount Gerizim nor in Jerusalem, but in spirit and in truth. Judea and Samaria is nearly a quarter of Israel's current landmass, not a small strip of land on the Jordan River, but a vital and strategic part of the nation's identity. The October 7th massacre, launched from Gaza, shattered the illusion that giving away territory brings peace. Gaza, which was once seen as the cornerstone of a two-state solution, became a launchpad for terror. Today, only 21% of Israelis support a Palestinian state. Trust in a two-state solution has all but collapsed. The Middle East is changing. Iran's grip is weakening. New alliances are forming. But Western countries and some U.S. officials still chase the mirage of a two-state solution. History speaks clearly. The 2005 Gaza withdrawal, backed by the U.S., led not to peace, but to a terrorist regime. Judea and Samaria are 24 times larger than Gaza, deeply woven into Israel's geographic and spiritual fabric. To surrender them would not bring peace. It would invite conflict and existential danger. Family Research Council stands with Israel's rightful claim to sovereignty. It's time for America to do the same, for history, for justice, and for lasting security in the Middle East. This is Washington Watch. I'm Tony Perkins, your host, and we're glad that you have joined us. The website, TonyPerkins.com, but as I've mentioned before, the best way to keep up with us is on the Stand Firm app. Go to the App Store and get the Stand Firm app. That way you can have unbroken Washington Watch connection no matter where you are in the world. And you can also get our news and commentary, the Washington Stand, from the news and commentary from a biblical perspective. And you can get my daily morning devotion that comes to you Monday through Saturday, the Stand on the Word. So go to the App Store and get the Stand Firm app. Speaking of the Word, our word for today comes from Deuteronomy 15. If there is among you a poor man of your brethren, you shall not harden your heart nor shut your hand from your poor brother, but you shall open your hand wide to him and willingly lend him sufficient for his need, whatever he needs. Beware lest there be a wicked thought in your heart, saying, the seventh year, the year of release, is at hand, and your eye be evil against your poor brother, and you give him nothing. And he cry out to the Lord against you, and it becomes sin among you. You shall surely give to him, and your heart should not be grieved when you give to him, because for this thing the Lord your God will bless you in all your works and in all to which you put your hand. Now, this follows the instructions of the third year tithe, which is used to help widows, orphans, and others with legitimate needs. Caring for the poor is a shared responsibility, and our giving allows us to operate in God's economy, where obedience invites his blessing. And our generosity reflects his character. And in God's economy, there are no limits to how he can bless us. To find out more about our journey through the Bible, text Bible to 67742. Well, even though Congress remains in recess this week, there is a lot happening, as we've already talked about today. And there's a lot of things you need to know about. But there's a lot of issues that call for thoughtful, biblical responses. And so I want to bring in our panel of reporters from the Washington Stand to walk us through some of the key stories that we're tracking this week and help us think through them from a biblical worldview. Joining us now is managing editor for broadcast Casey Harper and senior writer for The Stand, Joshua Arnold. Gentlemen, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Thanks, Tony.
Hi, Tony. Good to be with you.
All right, I want to start here. I want to start with Rahm Emanuel, former Chicago mayor and longtime Democratic strategist, former member of Congress. He is now saying that his own party has lost the plot when it comes to cultural issues. Now, he argues that Democrats have drifted away from the concerns of everyday Americans. Casey, let me begin with you. When you hear that, what do you think he's getting at, and what, you know, what are the Democrats missing?
Yeah, well, I think he really is on to something, and he's actually been making this point for a while. I mean, 10 months ago on The View, not that I would ask any of our viewers or you, Tony, to subject yourself to watching The View, Rahm Emanuel was making this same point in the aftermath of the last election, where Democrats were really doing an autopsy, asking how did President Trump win all 7 swing states? How did we get here? And part of the point that Rahm Emanuel is making, he's been making, is that Democrats became obsessed with far-left social issues that were very unpopular with the base. And he has a good turn of phrase where he says that Democrats were obsessing over transgender bathrooms and locker rooms in schools instead of obsessing over excellence in the classroom. And I think that's a point that's going to that rings well with the average person. It's like, yeah, wait a minute. Why have our reading scores, for instance, down, you know, to the lowest level that they've been in years? 50% of students are not reading at the level that they should be. And so we have a crisis of education in the country, and Democrats are focused on, you know, transgender bathroom access. They're trying to defund police while crime is up. So he's making the case they got to switch away from these unpopular and, by the way, unbiblical identity politics, you know, LGBT issues, and get down to things that are what he calls middle class values. And you know, I don't think we're going to still agree with a lot of the economic policies and things of the Democratic Party, but that's more of a Democratic Party that people might recognize from a 2 decades ago.
Yeah, Casey, this is where longevity comes into play. I can remember when Rahm Emanuel headed up the Democratic Committee in Congress for recruiting candidates back in 2005. Not that I want the Democrats to listen to it, but they should listen to it because he actually knows what he's talking about. Because what he did, what he's talking about is what he did back in 2005. What he did is he went into congressional districts, recruited candidates that were culturally aligned with their districts. Pro-gun, yes, pro-Second Amendment, pro-faith, Democrats who talked about their faith, Christian faith, and even pro-life Democrats. Heath Shuler was one from North Carolina. And he was successful when he pushed the Democrats to do this. They were successful in 2006 in taking control of the Congress, the House. Now, they lost it when Barack Obama and Nancy Pelosi pushed them on the Obamacare because it made a lot of the pro-life Democrats that won in these districts that had marginal Republicans. So all that to say, they ought to listen to this guy because he actually has a track record of coming through for the Democrats.
I think you're right about that. I mean, he pointed to, you know, he said, similar to what you said, he made that point. Again, I can't believe I'm citing The View twice, but he made that point on The View. He said, it worked for Obama, it worked for Clinton, but Democrats won't do it. But I'm not optimistic. I think Rahm's a voice in the wilderness. Democrats are not going to listen to him, is my prediction. I don't think that you can win a Democrat primary in the modern Democratic Party, which has been taken over by a pretty socialist fringe wing of the base that is really been radicalized by President Trump, not moderated. You have other people like Ezra Klein who are making the same point on the left. Ezra Klein, you know, he said we should have pro-life Democrats to win some of these tighter races, and he was absolutely destroyed by many in his own party. They're pushing AOC as a candidate, so I don't think they're moderating at all.
All right, Joshua, I'm going to bring you into this conversation that I'm having with Casey. What's your take on this? You've been writing about this.
No, I agree. I don't think the Democrats are moderating at all. You look at where the energy of their base is, and they're always out protesting, you know, on anti-Semitic issues, pro-Hamas against Israel. Right now, it's all against immigration enforcement in the country. A couple of summers ago, it was over the abortion issue. And when Dobbs came out, they were furious at the overturn of Roe v. Wade. The energy in the Democratic Party, which tells you where the direction it's going, is all on the far left. And that's really unfortunate because, especially on an issue like the transgender issue, you know, they claim to be pro-science, follow the science, but their ideology is anything but. You know, there's a biological reality that a man is a man and a woman is a woman, and you can't change that. And study after study comes out confirming that.
So, gentlemen, where does that leave the Republican Party? You know, if the Democratic Party has become beholden to this radical base that is so far, you know, left outside the mainstream, how do the Republicans respond in that environment?
Well, I think go ahead, Joshua. I've been monologuing. Please go, Joshua.
Sure. I think one thing Republicans can do is simply try to have conversations with people, you know, not impose the same sort of ideological litmus tests we see on the left, but actually seek to understand other people's positions, accept that there will be differences. When you have free speech and freedom of conscience in the society, people will come to different viewpoints, and we should work on trying to persuade one another instead of trying to shout one another down.
I agree with that. I agree with especially that last point. I think we can never abandon our principles when we come into the, as Christians, all right? As Christians, when we come into the political arena, we're advocating for something. I've always been very clear about this from day one when I stepped in 30 years ago. I'm for life. I'm for marriage between a man and a woman, and I advocate for that. Now, I also know that I have to bring people along. And we need to be able to make the arguments and have the conversation. And one of my biggest concerns where we are as a country right now is that we don't have those conversations. We don't even have debates between the left and the right anymore. That just doesn't happen. It's basically everybody is in their own huddle just shouting and screaming. I think at some point in time we've got to get back to having those conversations, but certainly we do need to be persuading what is left in the middle, very few left in the middle, but we need to be persuading them. All right, I got to move on here. We'll spend the whole time on this topic, one I like to talk about. But let's move on, Joshua. Earlier today, you were talking about anti-Semitism that is permeating the Democratic Party. Well, it's raising its head in the Republican Party. We're seeing more and more of that in the MAGA supporters. Lindsey Graham of South Carolina has vowed to root out anti-Semitism that's found within the Republican Party. Talk about it.
That's right. So the factor that brought this to the forefront is a couple of the challengers to Senator Graham in his Senate primary have hired very openly anti-Semitic staffers to their campaign. Paul Danz and Mark Lynch have both hired anti-Semitic staffers. One of these staffers posted a cartoon depicting Jews as cockroaches. Another depicted himself putting his foot on the Talmud, saying it was against Jesus Christ. So this sort of vile anti-Semitism is showing up on the right. And when Graham pressured these candidates to eject this anti-Semitism from their campaign, they basically accused Graham of being a shill for Israel and said, well, Israel doesn't control who we hire for our campaign. So we are seeing this kind of anti-Semitism rise up on the right. So earlier today, you were on this call as well. Senator Graham had a call with faith leaders. The faith leaders encouraged him to keep standing up for the safety and rights of Jews, to stand up against this vile hatred of anti-Semitism. One of the rabbis on the call, I think, thought made a really good point. There aren't a lot of Jews in South Carolina. There aren't a lot of Republican Jews, especially. But Senator Graham is standing up for the rights of Jews because he knows it's the right thing to do.
Well, and the point that I made on that call was that if you look historically, going back to the medieval times, whether you go into Nazi Germany, Russia, you pick it. What we've seen historically is that the marginalization and the persecution of the Jewish community is the canary in the coal mine to religious intolerance. And it's not going to stay to that community. It's going to move to Christians. It's going to move to other religious groups. So we have, I think as Christians, we have an obligation to speak out on their behalf. I mean, obviously, Christianity comes from, I mean, our scripture comes from the Hebrew scriptures. We have a lot in common with our Jewish brothers. I want to go to another topic. Casey, the president kind of doubling down on his speech. You know, he got a lot of pushback. We talked about it yesterday here on this program, right, where he used, I would say, unacceptable language in describing Iran and what he was going to do to Iran. And it's just unbecoming of a president. I would say unbecoming of a gentleman, period. My grandmother used to say people that use those words just have a poor vocabulary. I just think this is not acceptable. What do you make of the president's defense of his statement, saying that he was just trying to kind of bring them to the table? It was that bravado that he was trying to project.
Sure. I mean, I don't even really doubt that there's some truth in that explanation. And we are used to the president pushing boundaries, but I agree with you. I think he went too far on this. I mean, it's Easter morning. You're waking up. You might be at your sunrise service and you check your phone and to read that message from your leader, the commander in chief. There's sort of the moral question of the language. There's sort of the spiritual implications. There's the odd thing about praise Allah, which, you know, okay, that we're interpreting that a certain way as mocking Islam. Okay. But then I think the thing that even non-Christians in the country would read into that statement is it doesn't give you peace that this is being handled with a steady hand when we're on the verge potentially of World War III or regional escalation. That's really, I think, the political point there. And then it's also just an unforced error. The president doesn't need an F-bomb. He's got real bombs doing more than enough intimidation, sending the message to Iran. And the last thing I'll say is I think the president's a little bit off message here. He was doing well when he was focusing on the nuclear capacity, talking a little bit about the plight of the people in Iran, saying this is going to be a short war, but we'll finish the job. But now it's about the Strait of Hormuz. Maybe the war is about the oil. And now, maybe it's about the sitting back to the Stone Age, which I think is not nearly as palatable for Americans.
I'm glad you brought that up, Casey, because that's been my concern. What I've seen in the messaging in the last week or so, it shifted from nuclear capabilities as well as ballistic missile capabilities to oil. And we only get about 2% of our oil through the Strait of Hormuz. The United States, we're not dependent upon that, although it does affect global markets. I am concerned about that. But again, back to the language. This is where the president, you know, the art of the deal, he has been a great negotiator. And you know, that works as president probably 85-90% of the time. I mean, it's kind of the negotiating over, you know, a building in New York City in Manhattan. I mean, that works, that bravado works in that setting. But when you're the leader of the free world and you're trying to intimidate or send a message to the person you're negotiating with, in this case, Iran, everybody else is looking on and watching it. And it does not communicate peace, calm, and control. I think it's disturbing to a lot of folks.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. And I think there's also the sort of this question of moral authority. You know, we've been really critical of Iran for some of the things they've done. We've been really critical of Russia for the nature of their war against Ukraine. And by threatening power plants, by using this kind of language, you risk losing your moral authority, which is really important in keeping public support for what you're doing. It's politically important for the midterms, and it's really important for getting international cooperation, which the president, he's talking about leaving NATO. So there's a lot of chaos, and in a time of war like this, I think you're right that people are looking for a steady hand for leadership, which the president's very capable of doing, and I think he can do. We just got to get back on track.
Yeah. Joshua, I'll give you the last word.
Well, the great contrast to that is the rescue of the U.S. airman behind enemy lines, who his first message back was, God is good. He is good.
Yes, he is, all the time. All right, gentlemen, thanks so much for joining us. And folks, thank you for joining us. Your prayer list should be full. So keep praying, keep standing, and I'll see you next time right here on Washington Watch.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is brought to you by Family Research Council. To support our efforts to advance faith, family, and freedom, please text GIVE to 67742. That's GIVE to 67742. Portions of the show discussing candidates are brought to you by Family Research Council Action. For more information, please visit TonyPerkins.com.